everyone. Welcome back to Things We Read This Week. I'm Jordan Nanos, back with Hunter Holmgren after a nice Christmas holiday. We got episode 15 coming your way. We're going to talk about some releases of some models that happened over the Christmas holiday, some announcements at CES, announcements from OpenAI, Google, and walking robots. But before we do, Hunter, how was your break? What'd you work on over the past few weeks?
I mostly tried to do nothing, actually. I got my hands on a Flipper Zero, which, if you're not familiar with what that is, it's a more or less a tool to do nefarious things, but build as a learning experience to skirt import controls, I guess. No, it's pretty interesting. It's a device that's got Bluetooth. You can get a Wi-Fi module. It can read like RFID, NFC, those like iButton tags, right? So like I can clone a, work badge. I can, do packet capture on Wi-Fi. I can mess with touch tune systems at bars. I don't know. It's kind of cool to just like, it's a cool thing to screw around with and just learn about like how insecure a lot of the physical access control systems that we use every day really are. Right. I mean,
yeah,
that's really what it comes down to. I'm sure there's more things that it does. Like I was reading some Reddit thread about like, if you get this, it's like a super powerful infrared blaster that you have to hook up to like an external USB battery to even use, but like apparently it's powerful enough to change stoplights.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess no more waiting at red lights for this guy, but
okay, so you just a nice kidding. Christmas just present kidding. Yeah. You got yourself a nice Christmas present. Okay, well, speaking of Christmas presents that people gave out this week or the last couple of weeks, I guess we got some nice model drops. So the one that I want to talk about is DeepSeek version 3, released from a former hedge fund, current hedge fund in China. It kind of brings together a few different things that we've been talking about. One is that Chinese companies are releasing models open source today, and two is that they're really good. So DeepSeek specifically is set to outperform a lot of certainly open source models, but even some of the labs in the US. And I think the big thing is that it's rumored to have been trained on a cluster. Well, they say in their tech report, it was trained on a cluster of 2000 H800s, which is like a nerfed version of the H100 that can ship to China. And that's like $5 million, the run, the length of time on there, which is a lot less than the billions we're seeing people spend on 100,000 H100 or H200 clusters that are being built out right now. So,
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even like the previous DeepSeek 2.5, right? Just in some of the benchmarking that you did, outperformed a lot. And so it's like really interesting to have a model that outperforms so many of the other multi-billion dollar training run models that are out there with something that's basically $5 million, like it costs in the grand scheme of things, comparatively cost a little more than a rounding error.
Yeah, I mean, certainly hedge funds have $5 million to throw at something like this if they've got a team.
Once again, rounding error, right? Like $5 million to a hedge fund.
Yeah, it doesn't, like a 2000 GPU cluster does not cost $5 million. And I'll just put the author names on screen here and flash the technical paper. So, or the technical report. I mean, it's like...
100 additional authors not shown.
So, there's a few people who got their name on this report. But from the, training costs, it's like which run for pre-training did they actually publish? And so clearly, the amount of work that they put into infrastructure, and just like the distributed training stack is incredible. It's a mixture of experts model. So it seems to show some of the technology that's being used by the Frontier Labs in open source. And it's also got there's a reward model, like a reasoning model that's been that they trained to do some of the post-training work here, called R1, that they did not release, which uses the same chain of thought prompting that we've seen from O1, O3, and some of the Google models. So, I mean, huge advancement, I think, in terms of what we have available in open source. Putting aside the technical stuff, I think the coolest thing that I saw about this is that people are already running this on Mac minis. So, a 685 billion parameter model running on 8 Mac minis in a cluster. This guy, Alex Chima on Twitter, is getting 5 tokens per second on the first day it was released.
On a stack of 8 Mac minis, which is like $500 a piece.
Yeah, he's got it on screen here. He's got the Mac minis and the laptop set up because, well, this was released on Christmas Eve, so he was doing his work on
Christmas
Christmas
Day.
Day and Boxing Day. Yeah, the community's just really incredible here. But yeah, man, I mean, like, pretty incredible that we just like the curve just continues, the exponential improvement, and the influence. I mean, so let's imagine this is a hedge fund. They've got some use case for an LLM internally, right? The financial incentive for them to release something open source and, charge for an inference an API endpoint or something like that is like it's not financial, right? Like it seems to just be them bragging.
I mean,
I
it's
don't know what else to chalk it up to here.
bragging, I think, is a good word. I mean, it to me is a pretty incredible feat, right? To have a model that keeps pace with current closed source models, in all the standard benchmarks, yet was done on basically a what 1/50th of the compute power. Like that in a, that in itself alone, I think is like, I'd be bragging about that. I mean, yeah, like that's awesome. And it, I guess it begs the question, like, what is their technique? Meaning, like, what are they doing differently than everyone else who seems to be like, I need $1 billion more to, make ChatGPT 5. Which is
If you want to.
essentially what OpenAI is at right now. I mean, they're trying to raise more funding to do another big run, I
Yeah,
would
so
assume.
if you want to dig into this, like I could talk about a little bit of it because it's in the I encourage anybody who's interested in this to go read the technical report that they released. So section 3.2 on the training framework is fascinating. Basically, most frontier, not frontier, they all have their own stack, but most Frontier tier two, like most reports on how Llama was trained or how, Mosaic ML did their training of MPT or, deep like DeepSeek, sorry, DeepSpeed, the like open source training framework or Megatron or Torch, like fully sharded data parallel, they have a framework for how training happens. And it's like, first you split the data set and then you run different copies of the models. That's data parallel. And then you split into different pipelines where you're putting different sections of the model on different nodes or on different GPUs, specifically within a node. And then there's tensor parallelism, or in this case, because it's a mixture of experts model, there's expert parallelism where you're putting, you know, different, instead of just putting different layers, you're putting like different experts or different, you know, sections of the model on different GPUs. And so the way in which those splits happen and the way communication happens between the different sections of the model is really important for training performance, right? Like if your GPUs are sitting around idle waiting for data to come from a different GPU because it's late during its training, you're kind of wasting time, or you're not fully utilizing the network, or you're not fully utilizing the GPU, and you know, training is going to go slower. So these guys wrote an entire framework from scratch called, they called HAI-LLM, and they use this thing called dual pipe with communication computation overlap, so that they're getting basically extra computation happening while all reduces are happening across the network. So while GPUs are communicating to each other, the next like micro batch is actually being processed, which is just, you know, that's much faster. And then the actual implementation of this, they take some of the SMs, like some of the small little cores on the GPU, and dedicate it to the actual training that's running. And they have a proper ratio of this. So basically NVLink offers, here's their description here, it offers 3.2 times the bandwidth of the InfiniBand interconnect. Mm-hmm. So you want to do 3.2 times more computation locally before you sync globally.
Yeah.
And they do that accurately for their mixture of experts model. There's much more stuff. They do proper training in Float 8. They have a mixed precision framework so that they can have like activations and weights and gradients all stored in the proper quantization. Stored with the proper data type. Then they do quantization. Anyway, they finish all of this section 3 in their report by basically making recommendations to hardware vendors. So they say, like, you know, we've done all of this work. Where is it? I'm going to scroll down here. Section. Where is it? Section 3.5, suggestions on hardware design. We propose the following suggestions on chip design to AI hardware vendors. Like,
it's just unbelievable. So it's not enough to come out with a model that's as good or better than everything else out there and open source it, but they're also going to tell you how to do your job too. Like, hey guys, so we've done all this work and we think your hardware could use some tweaks.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's incredible. So lots to learn just by reading the paper and kind of soaking in a bit of the hubris. Maybe one comment that jumps to mind. I'm not going to share the full text here, but we talked about it on a previous episode with respect to, I think, Clem from Hugging Face, like the CEO of Hugging Face's comments on Chinese LLMs and how he was kind of concerned about the security aspects of it. Somebody pointed out that basically a lot of people use these LLMs to make decisions, broadly speaking, but specifically to write code. You know, this model writes a lot of code. And we just saw, I've talked about it, you know, again, another thing previously, but all of the vulnerabilities that were caught in the compression library in like the Linux kernel, and XZ utils. And you know, basically if a model is making recommendations to people to use certain libraries to implement code in a certain way, it could expose that code that's being written to vulnerabilities. And I think it's a simple example to illustrate like why you want to run with a model that you trust and why a DeepSeek model may not be the perfect choice for generating code in certain software systems.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, we've all seen the obvious downsides of backdoors in software, just given the news over the break about telecoms being hacked, right? The US Treasury being hacked. Like, almost yeah. Like if you put a door there, someone will find it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And yeah, I think the other thing that people have pointed out is that possibly this was trained on synthetic data generated by frontier models,
mm-hmm.
Which could be, you know, a violation of the terms of service for those models. And I find it funny that people are kind of doing a bit of whataboutism here for the Chinese models. It's like OpenAI is being sued by the New York Times for violating terms of service to generate their model, but then you can't use their model to generate some synthetic data to train
mm-hmm.
on. It's like, okay, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, lots of discussions about DeepSeek. I think it's cool to see. This is what you can basically do with 2000 H100s and a just completely sophisticated training stack. What can be done with more GPUs and people learning from this?
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it brings into question some of the dependencies on PyTorch. I would say that everybody has. It's like if everybody depends on PyTorch in the ecosystem, maybe they're not getting the best performance or the best resiliency or something compared to just right. building it all yourself from scratch.
Yeah.
But that split continues to happen. Like I've said this previously, like there's people who get inserted to AI at a certain level of abstraction. They're like, I'm going to train an XGBoost model for a basic classification use case and learn about machine learning. Mm-hmm. And then over time, it's like you can either go super high level where I'm going to use LLMs to build an AI powered application. I'm going to use real-time voice. I'm going to use the multimodal vision stuff. And you don't care how this thing gets trained. You don't even understand how the model works, but you're a software engineer who can prompt, get responses, display them to users, and build real applications. Meanwhile, there's other people who are like, I need to squeeze 15% more performance out of this inference endpoint yeah. so that I can save money or improve. And they're like going from, you know, intro in XGBoost to PyTorch to CUDA to like, you know, basically CUDA is a whole stack of different libraries, but like low level CUDA libraries. And, writing stuff for themselves. Now you're writing code in C instead of, you started in Python and you can go to like TypeScript or you can go start in Python and go down into C++.
Well, and that's I think it's true about a lot of other things in the technology space, right? I mean, if you want to squeeze as much performance out of a given system, the lower level you can go, the more control you have over the performance, right? I mean, it's yeah. why things like low latency tuning exist, right? Where I need like nanoseconds matter, right? I need to shave 3 nanoseconds off of this transaction. How do I do that? right? You have to be super low level to be able to do that. Whereas like, I think what stuff like AWS Lambda did to a lot of people is get them too high level, to where it's like, well, I don't have to understand things like libraries and runtimes and drivers and kernel versions. Like, I wrote an application and I want to run it. I don't really care about what's underneath.
Yeah.
You know, the whole
Yeah, exactly.
concept of serverless computing took people the other direction, right? Where they're just like super high level and they're like, well, I just wrote this in Rust. I don't understand why it doesn't run.
Haven't heard of Cargo, dude? How are you going to install this? Like, yeah, I know. The way we package stuff is interesting. Maybe also just a comment on the way this is getting run. So, I've joked about the M4 minis, the Mac chips, but there's this trend. Let's shift it to some announcements from CES. There's this trend that like we're gonna have all these open source LLMs running on your laptop or your phone. But NVIDIA's released Digits with at CES, which is basically a personal computer, a PC. Don't know how much power this thing's gonna need, but it's got a Grace CPU and a Blackwell GPU, GB10 they call it, and it's gonna be $3,000 or something like that. Jensen announced it on stage at CES. So, is like, where does that? There's this trend to make models of a certain quality that can do a certain amount of reasoning, like Llama 3.2, 1 billion, run really fast on a phone. And then there's this like, I need a supercomputer to run an inference endpoint of O3 reasoning with chain of thought for like an hour of compute to answer one complicated question. Where's this middle point where somebody needs Grace Blackwell under their desk?
I don't know that, I mean, I don't know that anybody needs Grace Blackwell on or under their desk, because I mean, realistically, like, why, right? I mean, do you really need to run a 70 billion parameter model at your desk? I would venture to guess
People are
probably
going
not.
to.
I know people are, I know people are going to, of course, like, people are going to do it. That thing's probably going to sell like hotcakes. Every engineer, that does anything in the AI space is going to be like, I got to have at least two of those under my desk, of course. I need one for dev and one for, production. I'm just going to be. The other thing I thought of
One
after
for
that
each
announcement.
wall, one for each plug in the wall outlet that you're plugging this thing into.
Yeah, and then pretty soon I got to have 480 volt coming into my house because I need to power all these things. No,
Oh,
but
God.
I had a funny thought about the digits thing. It's like you could totally get one and host your own like pretty damn good chatbot like privately, like from the comfort of your own home. And like if you want to get really fancy like I did, you run a WireGuard VPN service, and now like even when I'm traveling or not at home, right, I have access to this LLM that I can just, VPN from my phone into, and now I've got a private chatbot. Like, I think it's cool. Do I want to go and spend $3,000 to get a GB10 chip running at my house? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, do I think everyone needs it? No. Do I think people are going to
So,
buy them and buy a lot of them? Yes.
yeah, but they also announced the 5090, the follow-on to the 4090 consumer card, which takes the TDP from 450 watt to 575 watt for a single GPU, and people have multiple of these in their gaming rigs, right? So we're looking at like 2 kilowatt, 3 kilowatt power supplies for these freaking gaming systems.
When I built mine l last year, I put a 1200 watt power supply in, and I thought that was future proofing. And it's like you see these announcements, and you're like, nope, it's not.
Well, okay, but take that 1200 watt supply for your rig. Are you expecting GB10 to be 1200 watt for a system? Because that's
Well,
like a
what's GB? What's
GH200, like a single one, a single chip is 900 watt for the 141 gig H200. Is this is the B10 a nerfed? I guess we're just speculating. We'll learn soon, but
Well, I was going to say,
this is a kilowatt system, right? I don't
what's the
know.
power draw of GB200?
More than 900 watt, I think, because
Right.
GH200 is 900.
So I don't know, maybe it's like
1200 or something? Yeah.
maybe it becomes a simple math equation to figure it out of like, okay, if GB200 or if GB10 is, let's say, I don't know, 30% the performance of GB200, what does that equate to in wattage differences, right? Do I take, is it also 30% of the wattage? Or one of the things that I've struggled with over the years to figure out is why thermal design, like why TDP, like the actual design aspect of it, has gotten worse over time and not better. Like when I'm doing like benchmarking of like Intel CPUs, right?
Yeah.
There's certain Xeon processors that draw so far above their rated TDP, you hit throttling.
Yeah.
And I've often been like, why is this even a problem? Like, why does this CPU, you're telling me it's 400 watts at max turbo boost, all cores enabled, that's what it's going to draw. Yet what I'm seeing in the power regulator is 460 watts. That kind of becomes a problem in a data center setting, right? When I'm planning for 400 and then they're drawing 460. So it's like,
That's exactly what's been seen with the H200s so
yeah,
far,
right.
right?
And
Like
so that's
massive
my
spikes.
question with this whole GB10. It's like, are people going to be tripping breakers at their house because this thing decides to, overdraw itself during like periods of high stress or something. I don't know, right? I mean, that I think I would be worried more about that because I don't know that the industry, I'm not just picking on Intel, but like I don't know that the industry, NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, all these people designing chips have figured out how to eliminate these spikes, which can be dangerous in some
Yeah, I mean,
cases.
yeah. So there's like the implication of they call it a personal AI supercomputer. That to me means you can plug it into a wall outlet in your house. Like
Right.
you don't need to, sometimes run your supercomputer in your garage and sometimes charge your EV. Like that's not to me a personal computer, but NVIDIA has a number of different oxymorons in their language. This is a GPGPU, a general purpose graphics processing unit. Bit of jumbo shrimp there. And now we've got a personal supercomputer. So I don't know what the naming actually means anymore. I think the interesting thing about this is it will possibly continue to push ARM into the arms of the public, which is like, if we can have a real ARM-based, like I'm just curious what their recommended desktop's gonna be. We're gonna get some hardcore Linux propeller heads saying, you gotta run your like you're not installing Windows on this thing, I think.
No way, man. You gotta compile and manually install Spotify to be able to flex on everybody.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna be, like arguing about which Linux desktop is best for your digits supercomputer here, I think.
Well, so I'm it's funny because I'm just reading a I guess a spec article on digits now that we're a couple days past the announcement. And this article is saying that it can run a 200 billion parameter LLM, but you also have the ability to link two of them together and run a 405 billion parameter model.
Yeah. He said 200 billion on stage, which is
Yeah. And
crazy.
so apparently that's at FP4 precision.
That's the Blackwell GPU. It gives you the
Yep.
FLOP4 cores here, which I think the we're still waiting on the benefits of FLOP4 cores. Because we've got Int4 for quantization strategies today. I mean, the claim that you can run a 405 billion parameter model on, you know, chips that add up to 200 gigs of memory with like low quantization Int4 is that's possible today on server side. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man. How about we move on to one of Jensen's other announcements during that keynote related to quantum computing? You got an article
Yeah,
or something to share
I
here?
do here. Let me pull it up here for a second. So during that CES, Jensen said that it would be 15 to 30 years before quantum computing is commercially viable. And the CEO of D-Wave, who, if you aren't familiar, D-Wave is a company that makes quantum annealing computers. Said that, let me find it. He listed off a bunch of companies like MasterCard and NTT are using our quantum computers today, not 30 years, not 20 years, not 15 years, but right now today. And we've discussed quantum computing before, right? You know, and I think I said, like, I'm still sitting here waiting for like an actual production use case. And it would seem that these companies like MasterCard and NTT, for example, that were mentioned or name dropped in this article, have some sort of use cases for quantum computing. And you know, there was a later in the article, the CEO of D-Wave did acknowledge that Jensen could have been talking about gate model quantum computing, which is something that's still a theory, but in theory would, you know, bring quantum computing's, you know, compute power to like, you know, hundreds of millions of qubits in theory. Whereas right now everybody uses a technique called quantum annealing. Which results in much less qubits. Regardless of what Jensen meant, I just find this interesting because we've, you know, we've heard quantum computing talked about. A lot of it's been talked about in the cybersecurity space about how it's going to break everyone's encryption, and you know, we have to move everyone to pass keys because passwords are no longer safe because even Blowfish 448 can be cracked by a quantum computer. And like, you know, there's all this like fear and, you know, whatever going these conversations in the cybersecurity space. But like, okay, if quantum computers are really out there right now doing something, right?
Yeah,
My
I
passwords are
guess
still fine. I don't know. Like,
they're doing something. Yeah, they're taking up power, they're doing something. I don't understand what the comment in production means in that D-Wave response where the CEO was saying the MasterCard's using it in production.
In
Like,
production. Production of
Yeah.
what, like what production application? Like is my credit
Loyalty
card trans,
program
yeah, my
rep
loyalty
come
program
claim.
getting processed by a quantum computer? Like is it monitoring my, you know, how many times I go to the, you know, liquor store every week? Like I don't know. Like what is, like what are we doing with the, what are we doing with the quantum computer MasterCard? Like I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, is it does it mean it's in the production section of the data center so that it has moved from dev test to the place where users have access to it? I think that may be what is referred to here. Like, it's not scary, but the idea that it is, we've got highly available and backed up quantum computers that are running prod level applications. Oh my God. Did you see that in US East 1, the quantum cluster is down? We had to fall back to US East 2. I haven't really.
I know. I was gonna say, what's your business continuity plan for quantum, your quantum workloads,
Exactly. Yeah.
right? Like,
Your RTO and your RPO for your quantum cluster.
oh yeah. How do I back that up? And can I cluster them? Can I make it HA? Like, what's
Oh God,
the
I got bad news. We got hit by ransomware on the qubits today.
Oh man. Okay,
I don't get it, man. I don't get it. But
okay, so
whatever. The
I did a quick search just because I was curious, and MasterCard actually wrote an article, which is contradictory to what the D-Wave CEO said, is that they're using it for research. They have this project called the MasterCard Quantum Security and Communications Project. It's a research initiative that is doing it's for developing quantum resistant cards. And it's also for quantum computing for loyalty programs, as you just said.
wait, what's the
Yeah.
use case in loyalty?
Listen to this. MasterCard is exploring how quantum computing can help deliver the right offers to the right people at the right time. So you're trying to fucking reinvent targeted advertising with a quantum computer? Like, what? That makes no sense. What? Like, guess what, guys? Google and Meta figured it the fuck out without quantum computing. We don't
Okay,
need
all right, dude. Yeah, you know more than everybody at MasterCard and D-Wave. Come on.
No, I don't. I absolutely don't. I just think it's funny to read, right? Like you read a statement
When
like
I
that,
get
like
my
we're
credit card points and they recommend where I want to spend it, it's a perfect recommendation every time, man. Yeah, it's totally figured out. No,
that's
come
what I
on.
mean. They've employed string theory and gone through the quantum universe to figure out that you should spend your loyalty points at Chick-fil-A this week.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, yeah. Quantum's always a fun topic. Oh, let's talk about the future. What's up next? You have another one to share, right?
I do.
OpenAI is
OpenAI is
shifting their
turn
focus not to quantum, but to
super intelligence because general
a.
intelligence has already been figured out. AGI is dead. It's in the bag. We got it. We're good. Now it's super intelligence.
AGI's in the bag,
I love this. I love this quote. We love our current products, but we are here for the glorious future.
Oh, the glorious
The
future.
glorious future is super intelligence.
Yeah.
And massively increase abundance and prosperity. Like, is this guy, is Sam Altman giving a speech at the World Economic Forum, or is he just like making a product announcement? I can't figure it out.
Yeah. Well, we gotta wait for the Polymarket stuff to close here.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the So the definitions of AGI and ASI have always been interesting. I can make a comment here. One of my favorite Reddit comments that I saw on this was saying that intelligence was like mobility. So if a human can walk at 3 miles an hour, or 8 miles an hour, and maybe you can run at 20 miles an hour, but the fastest sprinter in the world, Usain Bolt, hits like 30, 35 something miles an hour. Like, I remember the top speeds of these guys in the Premier League in soccer, like 33 miles an hour or something like that. Anyway, AGI would be like a machine that can run as fast as a human. And then ASI would be like a machine that not just beats us in a race, but is like a plane that can go at Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 4. Like, it's just so much better at all of this intelligence stuff. This intelligence stuff that, you know, it's kind of like so far beyond what we can understand. AGI and specific benchmarks to try and find AGI, it seems like this cat and mouse game that's happening right now, where you have this really incredible model that can do just about anything reasoning wise, right? And then people find some ways in which it fails, and they go, well, it's not AGI yet because it fails. And you go, well, some humans still fail at some things, even if they're the smartest humans on the planet. And so they start designing these benchmarks that specifically are easy for humans and hard for models, like the ARC AGI benchmark that O3 passed pretty clearly, pretty quickly. I get, you know, this term, people say this term, like there's echoes of AGI in the current models. I don't understand what that means. I just use these models and they make stuff up sometimes about code and Linux packages, you know. They just don't know everything on the internet yet. And to me, the idea that one of these models is better than a smart new grad with access to Google to search stuff, it's just not. Like, it can do a lot of things faster than that person can do, but it cannot handle all of the edge cases. So right. I don't know how there's a shift to super intelligence happening right now. Like, they think the training run for AGI is just, it's already being done. You've already compressed the entire internet into this transformer model, and you can retrieve it with any natural language question that you could ask a person. I don't think it's happened yet. I don't know.
I don't think it's happened either. And I mean, we've talked about the whole goalpost moving that's been done on AGI. And what is the definition of AGI? Well, it might mean something to the people claiming they have it versus something like, to your point, right? Like, they might say, oh, I've got AGI in this model and it passes the AGI benchmark. And then people find things wrong with it, or it hallucinates in certain topics, or it, you know, screws up in some way, gives bad information about something, right? Okay, well, are you really going to sit there and argue that human beings also sometimes give incorrect answers, and that is why we're declaring AGI? Like, I thought
the argument, if I'm going to steel man the argument that AGI has been achieved or is close, it's the idea that every single task you can come up with that you think the model's failing at, you can solve with some post-training or some better data. You can train the behavior into the model to solve those ARC AGI, you know, square box puzzles, or to generate images or videos, or, you know, what, like, name your cognitive task: to write a research report, to make a recommendation if this is fraud or not, to, like, to do everything better than an expert human: play chess, play Go, play StarCraft, right? And it does seem like the foundation models that these people have pre-trained can be tuned or post-trained to perform just about every task that a human can be expected to do for valuable work, right? Like, I could train a model to do, I could theoretically fine-tune a model to do just about everything that I can do, literally everything that I did in the last week in my job, with enough labeled data and examples of me doing it. Like, data of me controlling my computer screen, or of me writing some code, or of me giving a presentation and explaining something. You could theoretically train a model to do all of these things. The barrier seems to be gathering that data and those examples and actually the like tasks that humans are expected to do, because there's so much surface area covering all of the different tasks that we are expected to do in our daily jobs, and those things change over time. And
well, here's a question that brings up an interesting question though. If I can train a model, like if I can build Jordan GPT and I can just have Jordan GPT do everything that you do, do I make a model do that? Like, what I'm trying to say is, do I make a model do that for you and I and the rest of our team, and that our team becomes one model? Or do I have a model for Jordan and a model for Hunter and a model for, you know, whoever else, right? Like, this kind of gets back to like, what
some
is
some might so, say an agent.
Oh God, no, don't, we're not going down the agent thing again. but you know, you see what I'm getting at, right? Like, cause we've had this conversation about like a model that does everything versus a model that does one thing really well. Right. Like,
well, that's the context of AGI, right? Conceptually, the way I always envisioned AGI was it's one model that does everything. It's not fine tunes for specific tasks.
Right.
And so the business value today seems to come from fine tuning for specific tasks, or from prompting for specific tasks, or whatever. Right. And the reasoning models seem to show that there's like more training, more data just makes it better at everything. Mm-hmm. Like the whole insight of you train it on code and it gets better at predicting fraud in English language with no extra English language tokens was, it's this crazy, the model is learning some logic in learning in, you know, predicting the next token in a program that is somehow applicable to other domains outside of programming, right? Mm-hmm. But okay, let me take a step back. There's this framework, this classic consultant 2x2, right? There are tasks that are cognitive versus manual, like somebody has to think to do it versus somebody has to work with their hands. And then there are tasks that are repetitive versus creative. Somebody has to do something they've never done before, and somebody has to do something they've done 100 times before, 1,000 times before. The promise of AI was that it was always going to automate white collar, repetitive cognitive tasks.
Like data entry and...
Exactly, right?
Yeah, stuff like that.
Which is fundamentally, like, you can say that about software, just generally speaking, right?
Sure.
So the thing that is that, you know, maybe that's the bottom left of the 2x2, where some things are more creative and other things are more manual or more repetitive, and other things are more cognitive, more manual, right? There's two axes by which this model is improving. One is that it's getting better at performing tasks that it's never seen before, or only seen one example of, or are just similar to something else, and it hasn't done it 1,000 times before with training data. And the other thing is that with the world models and these robotics, it's getting better at actually taking actions in the real world. So doing things that are manual, like literally walk around and fold the laundry and cook dinner, right? And to me, I don't understand how you can claim AGI in the purely cognitive setting. I think that's what they would try to do here, which is to say, if the only way you interact with a human in a setting is over a computer interface, over a network, replacing the human on the other side of the network with a model on the other side of the network, it can basically do anything the human could do, as long as it doesn't interact with things in the real world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this extra step, which is do interactions in the real world, either by asking humans to do it, the AI putting us to work.
Or by doing what Anthropic did and like taking control of your mouse and doing it.
Yeah. Or by having machines in a warehouse do something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or drones on a battlefield, right? Like, mm-hmm. who's going to win, you know? Human general with troops on the ground,
years
infantry,
experience, yeah.
Or StarCraft tuned model with drones. You know, a little scary, but I'm betting on the computer right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same way I'd bet on the chess, like I'd bet on Stockfish over Magnus Carlsen in chess. Like the computer system, or AlphaGo over Lee Sedol in Go, the DeepMind trained Go player, right? AlphaZero, mm-hmm. whatever it is now. So, yeah, it's I don't know, a brave new world.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, I think there's something to say about the world power race for AI supremacy, if you're using that as an example of like, you know, a StarCraft tuned AI model that can send 100 drones out to a battlefield and strike with 100% precision and accuracy. Like, you know, at the end of the day, what is this all? What are we really driving towards? Like, military supremacy, like, you know, like,
oh, no. Well, let's I mean, okay, maybe we can keep scaring people that way, but here's the last thing I want to show for this week, which I think relates to the physical AI thing. So I sent you this, but yeah, just watch this video, this robot walking. And I mean, first of all, it's just incredible to see this thing walk like a human. Such a leap over all the Boston Dynamics videos.
I was just gonna say, you almost should bring up a video of the Boston Dynamics robot to see how unfluid the movement is, right? Because like, you look at this and you're like, I mean, if you put clothes on that thing and like a you know, a mask or something, like, would you really be able to tell that was a robot? Or would you be like, oh, that's just another person?
It's crazy. It's unbelievable. But I want to point out the context of where I saw this. So Dr. Jim Fan from NVIDIA, senior research manager, co-founder of the Gear Lab, he works on general robotics and physical AI. And his, you know, the world's most valuable company, right? Just a reminder of what NVIDIA is. And his comment on here, allegedly shot in Shenzhen, is this real? Can someone verify? I've seen this company posting very natural humanoid walking gaits a couple months ago. These days, it's hard to tell CGI versus Sora versus real video. It's real. Like, people have verified this. They have multiple angles of this thing walking around. This mm-hmm. is not this is not animation. And the guy who works in this domain at NVIDIA is so shocked by it. His first thought is this real? That's like scary, man. That is scary.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's
okay, let me pull up just his tweet. We can end off here. Folks, it's real. I verified from reliable sources, new visual Turing test, and then he shares another video of it walking from behind, like the same area. He says the controller is a neural net trained in Isaac Simulator, which is an NVIDIA software package, uses reinforcement learning and then sim to real. Reward engineering is all you need. And then he says, walking gates got swag, but we need these robots to go firefighting ASAP. A little current callback there. So
yeah, wow. It is incredible to see. I actually just I just thought of, let me see if I can pull this up. One of the things that, of course, that always pops into my head every time I see stuff like this is
Oh my God.
like obviously that's a little different because in that movie the T-1000 could turn into liquid metal and then reform itself, but and also take the face and body and clothes of anything it looked at. But you know, it's just wild to me to see stuff like that, like the I don't know, the drone, the whole drone AI controlled drone thing got me thinking about the exact same thing, like the opening scene in that movie.
Yeah, I don't know where the reasoning's going here. We didn't get a chance to cover it this week. I think we got to wrap up, but there's possibly an announcement coming out today that Biden is creating a three-tier system for export controls on chips, with China and Russia being adversaries that are blocked from having NVIDIA and AMD chips.
Yeah, a little preview of next week. We'll also talk about Google's new team that they're forming to build AI that can simulate the physical world.
Yeah, crazy, man. All right.
Yeah.
Nice job.
Thanks, everyone.